Stopping in a copse of trees a short distance from the ranch house, Smoke studied it for a moment or two. The house was built of logs with a sod roof. If it came to it, it'd burn easily.
Casey! Casey! Come out!
Who's calling?
Jensen!
Jensen? I thought we killed you.
That's my pa and my brother.
What do you want?
I'm here to settle up.
Smoke took his horse into a ravine that circled the house. 50 yards behind the house, he dismounted. Smoke snaked his rifle from the saddle sheath, then lay against the bank of the arroyo. Inside, he saw an arm on the windowsill. He shattered the arm with one shot from his new Henry. A moment later, he saw someone's outline through one of the other windows.
You boys in there! You want to die for Casey, do you? Already killed two of you back on the road!
Your daddy rides with most meat!
That's right!
You had a brother named Luke!
I did!
Yeah, well, he was shot in the back and the gold he was guarding was stolen. Casey done it, not me! You got no call to come after me!
Smoke fired several more rounds into the house.
Jensen! The name is Barry. I come from Nevada. Didn't have nothing to do with no war. Never been east. There's another fella in here just like me. We earn cattle for wages. We ain't got no stake in this fight.
Come on out and ride away then. I won't shoot you.
The cabin door opened and two men came out with their hands up.
We're just going to get our horses.
Go ahead.
The two men moved toward the barn. Both were shot in the back by someone from within the house.
What'd you do that for, Casey? They weren't part of this.
When I pay men to work for me, I expect loyalty.
Smoke didn't answer. He was quiet for several moments, trying to decide what he should do.
Jensen? Jensen, you still out there? Jensen, come on down. Come out in the open so I can see you and we can talk. Jensen, you out there?
I think he's gone.
That's what he wants us to think, you fool.
Smoke followed the arroyo on around to the bunkhouse. In a pile behind the bunkhouse, he found a bunch of rags, and in the bunkhouse, a jar of coal oil. He stuck the rags down into the mouth of the coal oil jar, lit it, and threw it at the ranch house. The jar broke, and the fire erupted almost immediately. As the logs burned, they began filling the house with smoke and fumes. From inside the house, Smoke heard coughing. Then, one man broke from the cabin and started running. Smoke cut him down with his rifle. A second began running, and Smoke pulled the trigger on the rifle, only to hear the hammer fall in an empty chamber. Smoke pulled his pistol and shot the man once, watching him double over with a slug in his gut. Casey waited until the last minute before he stumbled out into the yard, his eyes blinded from the smoke and fumes.
Where are you, Jensen? You yellow trash! You're gonna cry like your brother and your old man?
He fired wildly as he stumbled around, finally pulling the trigger repeatedly on an empty gun. Smoke walked calmly up to him, even as Casey was trying to reload, and knocked him out. Just outside the little town of Prosperity, Smoke dumped a bound and gagged Casey onto the ground. Curious about what was going on, several townspeople came forth to watch as Smoke took a rope from the saddle of Casey's horse and began making a noose.
What do you think you're gonna do here?
Obvious, isn't it? I'm gonna hang the son of a bitch who killed my brother and my pa.
I am an officer of the law. What if I ordered you to stop?
Then I'd just kill you and hang him.
But you can't do this. He hasn't been found guilty.
Yeah, he has. He's already admitted it to me. I also watched him kill two of his own men and shot him in the back.
That doesn't make what you're doing right.
It's right in my book.
Smoke put the noose around Casey's neck, then threw the other end of the rope over a tree limb.
Get up on your horse.
You go to hell.
Have it your way.
Smoke tied the end of the rope to the saddle horn. He raised his hand to slap the horse on the rump.
No way! Not that way!
Casey's hands were tied in front of him, but he put them on the pommel and swung himself into the saddle.
You got anything to say before I send you to hell?
Smoke yanked the gag out of Casey's mouth.
Yeah, I already sent your brother and your pa there. And when I get there, I'm gonna kick them both in the ass. Now do your damnedest, you son of a bitch.
Smoke slapped Casey's horse on the rump. With a protesting whinny, it leaped forward. Casey, dying quickly from a broken neck, swung back and forth from the tree branch.
I'll be notifying the governor about this.
You do what you think you need to do.
Without looking back, Smoke walked over to his horse, swung into the saddle, and rode away.
Son of a bitch. That's the damnedest thing I done ever seen.
True to his promise, Eddie managed to get Matt a job at McDougal's Saloon. There, Matt emptied and shined a spittoon, swept and mopped the floors, washed dishes, chopped wood in the wintertime, and swatted flies in the summertime. During the school year, they came to work at the saloon for 2 hours before school opened, then worked from 3 o'clock until 11 every night. Despite the long hours, the owner of the saloon, Drew McDougal, did treat them fairly, and he did provide them with lunch every day. For their labors, Matt and Eddie were paid $1.50 per week, but the money went to the home, not them.
This money is needed to pay the expenses.
As time went by, Matt learned that every penny any of the home residents earned went directly to Captain Mumford. And while he claimed to spend it all on upkeep, there was no one to look over his books but him. Whatever he spent it on, Matt was certain it wasn't spent on food or clothes. He got new clothes only when he outgrew what he was wearing or when he wore them out. In Matt's case, it was generally a matter of outgrowing them because he had grown considerably in his 3 years at the orphanage. Although there were several kids who were older than his 12 years old, only two, Connors and Simon, both of whom were 16, were bigger than he. And in their case, they were only marginally bigger. In the early days of Matt's stay in the home, Connors and Simon sometimes took it upon themselves to punish him for real or imagined infractions. But there came a time when Connors told Matt to bend over and grab his ankle so he could swat him.
Hit me with that paddle one more time and I'll cram it down your throat.
Startled by Matt's challenge, Connors walked away without administering the punishment. And now, neither Connors nor Simon were courageous enough to take him on by himself. Matt's size, courage, and demeanor made him a popular leader among the others in the home, and even those who were older than Matt looked up to him. That was why, when Matt told them all to follow his lead and not eat supper one night, no one questioned him as to why they should do such a thing. When they went through the line for supper, they accepted their bowls of peas porridge and then went to their tables. As they looked toward Matt, he reminded them by sign and signal that they were not to eat their porridge. In the meantime, they watched as Connors and Simon walked confidently back to their table. Unlike the other residents of the home, neither Connors nor Simon had to go through the line. Instead, they were served at their seats. One of the kitchen workers brought two bowls out to him and set them down on the table in front of Connors and Simon. She turned on her heels and walked back to the kitchen.
Here, hold on. What is this?
It's your supper.
The hell it is. We're having ham tonight.
The kitchen worker shook her head.
No ham.
What's going on here? What's happening to our ham?
I hadn't seen any ham.
Though none of the other residents laughed out loud, they all repressed giggles and smiles when they watched the frustration of the two oldest of their number as they tried to eat the peas porridge.
What is this? Nobody can eat this shit.
At a nod from Matt, everyone got up from the table and took their untouched bowls of porridge to the garbage can. There, they dumped the porridge, turned the bowls in, then filed out of the dining room.
Connors, did you see that?
Did I see what?
None of them ate.
Yeah, well, who can blame them?
No, you don't understand. None of them ate a bite. They always eat.
Yeah, you're right. I wonder why not. Hey, why don't you follow him, Simon? See if you can figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I will.
Simon slipped out of the dining room, then, hanging back a little, watched as the others went into the chapel. Curious, he moved to the door of the chapel, then looked inside. Everyone was sitting quietly in the pews with their heads bowed and their eyes closed. Matt turned in his pew and spotted Simon at the door.
Simon, so good to see you here. Come on in.
What?
Why don't you go get Connors and bring him with you? We would love to have you two join us.
What are you doing?
Why, we're having a prayer service, of course.
What do you mean you're having a prayer service? How can you have a prayer service if there ain't no preacher here?
You don't need a preacher to have a prayer service. All you need to do is pray. Won't you join us?
He reached out as if to grab Simon and pull him on into the chapel. Simon held out his hand as if warding Matt off. He shook his head.
No! I ain't doing no praying.
What about Connors? Won't you ask him to join us?
You're crazy! There ain't neither one of us gonna be coming in here and saying a bunch of prayers.
Then we will pray for you.
You're crazy, I tell you. Every last one of you.
Oh, Simon?
What?
Enjoy your peas porridge.
You're crazy!
Matt waited for a moment, then looked over at Eddie.
Make sure he's gone.
Eddie went to the door, looked through it, then turned back.
He's gone.
Let's eat.
With that, everyone crowded up to the altar where, from beneath the pulpit, Matt pulled out a large cooked ham.
Oh, this looks so delicious.
The excited young woman, Tamara, was 2 years older than Matt. In the early days when Matt first came to the home, it had been Tamara who recognized the grief he was suffering and who tried, as well as she knew how, to comfort him.
Where'd you get it?
The ladies of the Episcopal Church cooked it especially for us. I just happened to be outside Captain Mumford's office when they brought it. Captain Mumford thanked them for it, then told Connors that he and Simon could both have a little of it before he took it home.
Took it home? He was gonna take it home?
Yeah. You think peas porridge is all we ever get? Churches and the like been bringing us food ever since I got here, only we don't ever see any of it.
That ain't right.
I agree, Billy, it isn't right. So that's why I decided to do something about it.
Get this ham?
Yeah, get this ham. I waited until Captain Mumford stepped out of the office, then I took it and brought it here.
Well, I wouldn't have had the nerve to do that.
Sure you would have. All you would have had to do was smell it when you were hungry.
When is anyone not hungry in here?
Timmy carved the ham, and several came back for seconds until everyone ate their fill. Now, the only thing remaining was the large ham bone.
What are you gonna do with the ham bone?
My mama always made beans with it. Beans and cornbread.
Oh, beans and cornbread. If I weren't so full right now, that'd make me really hungry.
Seriously, what are you gonna do with it? If you throw it away and Captain Mumford discovers it, we're all gonna get in trouble.
Yeah?
Matt let a grin spread across his face.
If Captain Mumford discovers it, he really will be mad, won't he? I mean, really mad. There's no telling what he might do.
I'll say what... Wait a minute. You're up to something, aren't you? What are you gonna do?
You'll see.
Matt, do be careful.
I will be.
The next evening, just before supper, Captain Mumford came into the dining room.
I want all of you to line up. Boys on the right, girls on the left.
Everyone did as ordered, though nobody had any idea what it was all about. They began talking among themselves, asking questions and speculating as to what this was about.
Shut up! All of you, just shut up!
Captain Mumford, you want me and Simon to go take care of some of the loudmouths?
I do not, sir. I want you two to stand over there with the boys.
You're asking us to stand over there with them?
I'm not asking you anything. I am telling you.
Simon and Connors exchanged worried and confused glances, then walked over to stand against the wall with the others. Mumford was holding a gunny sack.
Anytime you get several people living together, as we do here, the one thing that you must be able to count on is trust. You must be able to depend upon one another to be loyal and honest. The worst thing that can happen in a society such as ours is that one might steal from another.
Mumford stuck his hand down into the gunny sack, then pulled out the remnants of the ham the residents had eaten the night before.
This ham was to have been a gift to you.
Mumford took in the residents with a wave of his hand.
To all of you. It was provided to us by the ladies of St. Paul's Episcopal Church. I had it on my desk, ready to take back to the kitchen for your supper. I stepped out for but a moment, and when I came back, it was gone.
No one made a sound.
Stolen!
Mumford looked over at Simon and Connors.
Then this morning I found this ham bone in the trunk shared by these two.
What? Look here, we didn't have nothing to do with stealing that ham.
I will not tolerate stealing, sir, and I will not tolerate lying.
But we didn't.
Hush, sir. Hush your foul mouth. You are both 16 years old, I have kept you on here out of the goodness of my heart. But I am not required to keep anyone beyond the age of 16. So I am ordering both of you out of here tonight.
What do you mean, out of here? Where are we supposed to go?
I don't care where you go as long as you aren't here. If I see either of you here ever again, I shall go to the sheriff's office and have you both charged with trespassing.
I don't know. Who did this to us?
Connor's searing gaze took in the boys and girls lined up on either side of the dining hall.
But when I find out, I will get you. I will get you for this. I promise.
Get out.
Connors and Simon both left. The next day, Mumford asked Matt to come to his office.
Yes, Captain Mumford?
I've been watching you, Matt, and I like the way you handle yourself. Connors and Simon served their purpose well as long as they were here. But they outlived their purpose, and it was time for them to go.
I think everyone was happy to see them go.
Maybe so. Still, as I say, they did serve their purpose. Now, Matt, when you are in charge of something like this, you need people to help you. Specifically, you need someone who is himself a resident. Someone who knows what's going on. Who knows what the others are talking about. Someone who can report back when they see misbehavior.
Matt said nothing.
I'm sure you saw how much better Connors and Simon had it than the rest of you.
Yes, we all saw that.
It is a necessary part of the procedure. I could not expect someone to work for me without some sort of compensation. In the case of Connors and Simon, I compensated them by allowing them to eat better, to have better accommodations. And, of course, I will do the same thing for you.
For me?
Yes. Winter is coming on. This will be your third winter. I'm sure you remember how cold and drafty the dormitory is. But if you move down to the end where Connors and Simon were, you will find it much warmer and much more comfortable.
Why would I move down there?
Well, if you are working for me, then it is your due.
You want me to do what Connors and Simon did? You want me to spy for you, Captain?
Yes.
Matt shook his head.
No. No, I won't do it.
The smile left Mumford's face.
You have no choice. You will do it because I am ordering you to do it.
I can't do it.
Matt sat with Tamara later that night on the back porch of the home.
I won't do it.
I thought you said he ordered you to do it.
Matt nodded.
He did order me to do it, but I'm not going to. I can't be like Simon and Connors. I can't turn on the others in here.
Tamara reached up to brush a fall of hair back from Matt's forehead.
You wouldn't be like them. You couldn't be like them.
There might be some who wouldn't understand. They would think I'd turned against them.
There might be some who would think that. But I would know better. So would Eddie and Timmy and Billy.
Matt shook his head.
Maybe, but I'm not going to take that chance.
What do you mean? What are you going to do?
I'm leaving this place.
Leaving? But where will you go? How will you live?
I don't know, but any place is better than this.
When are you going?
Tonight, when I know everyone is asleep.
Tamara didn't answer right away. Finally, she reached over and put her hand on his.
Matt, take me with you.
Tamara, I can't. Like you said, I have no idea where I'm going or what I'm going to do. Winter is coming. I could freeze to death up in the mountains if I don't starve first.
I don't care. I'm willing to take that chance if you are.
Tamara, I...
Matt, please. I'm 14 years old now. Next year I'll...
You'll what?
Matt, don't you know what Captain Mumford makes the older girls do to earn money?
I thought all the older girls worked at Emma Smith's boarding house.
And you have no idea what goes on there?
Don't you just clean and cook and make up the beds and such?
Beds, yes. Only we don't just make them up.
Matt realized what Tamara was talking about.
Are you saying that Captain Mumford makes you be with men?
Tamara nodded and her eyes brimmed over with tears. One began sliding down her cheek and she reached up to brush it away with the tip of her finger.
I didn't know that. I've been here for 3 years and I didn't know that.
Captain Mumford says he will horsewhip any girl who tells. Besides, it's not something anyone would want to tell anyway.
Are you...
Not yet. He doesn't make anyone start until they're 15.
I'll take you with me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Tamara spontaneously embraced Matt and kissed him on the cheek.
Be ready to go tonight.
What time?
I don't know. After midnight sometime, when everyone else is asleep. You be standing in the door of the girls' room looking for me. I'm not coming in there.
I'll be there.
Matt wasn't sure exactly what time it was when he left. He knew it was late at night because everyone was asleep and he could hear the snores and rhythmic breathing of the others. It was getting colder outside and he had no overcoat, so he decided to take the blanket off his bed. He walked gingerly in bare feet down the hall and stood just outside the girls' dormitory. When Tamara didn't come out, he decided to leave without her, but suddenly she was there.
When I saw you with the blanket, I thought that might be a pretty good idea, so I went back to get mine.
All right, let's go, but keep quiet.
Matt and Tamara tiptoed through the darkened building, passing through the dining room, then making their way into the kitchen. There, they found several chunks of stale bread, which they stuck down into their pockets. Then, wrapping themselves in the blankets, they sneaked out through the back. Once outside, they looked back toward the building that housed the home for wayward boys and girls. For a moment, Matt almost went back in. It wasn't much, but it was the only home he'd had for the last 3 years. For some of the residents, it was the only home they'd ever known.
Are you sure you want to go with me? I mean, when you think about it, the home kept us warm in the winter, gave us a place to sleep, and provided meals.
Such as they were.
We are giving up a safe haven for the unknown.
Who are you trying to talk out of going? Me or you?
I don't know. Both of us, I guess.
Matt shook his head.
But I can't stay. I cannot and I will not replace Connors and Simon.
The moon was full and bright, and it lit the path for them. A cool night breeze caused Matt to shiver, though in truth he didn't know if his trembling was entirely from the cold or from nervousness over his uncertain future. He pulled the blanket around himself and began walking. The home for wayward boys and girls was 3 blocks from Muddy Creek, and while it wasn't a conscious goal, Matt quickly found himself on the bank of the creek, looking down at the water. That's when he saw the boat.
There!
Matt pointed to the boat.
That's our way out of here.
We're gonna steal a boat?
Nah, we're not stealing it. We're just borrowing it. You keep a watch out while I untie it.
Scrambling down the creek bank, Matt started untying the boat. Matt scrambled back up the bank.
Tamara! Tamara, what is it?
Someone's coming.
Come on, hurry!
No, you go ahead. I'll lead them away from the water.
Tamara, no, come on! Hurry, we have to go now!
You go on!
Matt saw Tamara turn and run away from the top of the bank.
Help! Help me!
What are you doing out here, girl?
I don't know! I think I must have been walking in my sleep. I just woke up out here. I'm lost and frightened. Please help me get back to the home.
As Tamara distracted whoever had been alerted by the dogs, Matt stepped into the boat and pushed himself off. Picking up the paddle, he helped the swift flowing water propel him downstream. It was 5 or 6 miles before the creek petered out and couldn't support the boat. Matt abandoned it and started walking. He stayed close to the creek because it was a source of water and because he had an idea that it might eventually lead him somewhere. He ate the last of his bread on the third day. On the fourth day, he found some wild onions and ate them, though the taste was so bitter that he could barely keep them down. He had nothing at all to eat on the fifth day, but on the sixth, he managed to catch a frog. He remembered eating frog legs back in Kansas, but they were rolled in batter and deep fried. He had no way of cooking these legs. He had no matches. But he did have a pocket knife, and he cut off the legs, skinned them, and ate them raw. An early snow moved in just before nightfall of the sixth day, and the single blanket Matt brought with him did little to push away the cold. It was also tiring to try and hold the blanket around him while walking. He considered cutting a hole in the middle, but decided against it because he thought it would be less warm at night that way. As the snow continued to fall, it got more and more difficult to walk. At first, it was just slick, and he slipped and fell a couple of times, once barking his shin on a rock so hard that the pain stayed with him for quite a while. As the snow got deeper, he quit worrying about it being slick and concerned himself only with the work it took just to keep going. His breath started coming in heaving gasps, sending out clouds of vapor before him. Once he saw a wolf tracking him, and he wished that he had his father's rifle. He found a limb that was stout and about as thick as three fingers. Using his knife, he trimmed the smaller branches off it, then managed to cut it to just the right size. He was able to use the limb as a cane to help him negotiate the deepening snowdrifts. Just before dark, he sensed more than heard something behind him, and turning quickly saw that the wolf, crouched low, had sneaked up right behind him. Holding the club in both hands, he swung at the wolf and had the satisfaction of hearing a solid pop as he hit the wolf in the head. The wolf yelped once and turned and ran away, trailing little bits of blood behind it as it ran. Matt felt a sense of power and elation over that little encounter. He was sure that the wolf would give him no further trouble. After the sun set, he found an overhanging rock ledge and got under it, then wrapped himself in the blanket. When night came, he looked up into the dark sky and watched as the huge white flakes tumbled down. If it weren't for the fact that he was probably going to die in these mountains, he would think the snowfall was beautiful.
Lord, I reckon I haven't been all that good at praying, even though we had a chapel back at the home. And I know that Mama used to pray to you all the time, and she seemed to take a lot of comfort in it. So if you don't mind hearing from someone like me, I'm going to pray to you now. And I want you to look out for Eddie and Timmy, all the other kids back at the home. Truth is, Lord, I probably shouldn't have left. Without me there to take care of them, there's no telling what Captain Mumford's going to put them through. And there's no telling who he's going to get to take the place of those two no-accounts, Connors and Simon. But that's spilt milk, Lord. The home is back there. I'm here. And I probably wouldn't live long enough to make it back even if I tried. Probably going to die pretty soon now. Of course, I don't reckon I have to tell you the way things are right now. I'm out of food, it's getting colder, and the creek has quit, so I'm out of water, too. I know Mama is up in heaven with you. She was a very good woman. And Cassie's up there, too. Though I didn't know Pa all that well, seeing as he was off to war for most of my life, well, I figure he's probably up there also, because I don't think Mama would have married a bad man. Now it comes to me, Lord. And I have to confess that my chances don't look all that good. I killed those two men back at the wagon. Well, I don't have to tell you about it. You saw me do it. Can't rightly say that I shot either one of them to save my family, because, as you know, my family was already dead. The only reason I shot them is because they needed killing. And I have to be honest with you, Lord. I aim to hunt down Payson and Garvin, the others who were with them, and kill them as well. So if you let me live through this, and I'm going to take it that it's all right with you. And if it isn't all right with you, Lord, then I hope you just go ahead and take me tonight. Amen.
Finishing his prayer, Matt pulled the blanket more securely around him, pulled up his legs, then leaned back against the rock. Strangely, the cold seemed to be less intense, and he felt his body warming. He also felt his eyes growing very heavy, and he closed them. Then drifted off to sleep. The sudden snowfall caught Smoke by surprise. It shouldn't have caught him by surprise. Preacher taught him well how to gauge the change in weather.
When clouds is low in the west and there's these long, scraggly tails hanging down from them, like as not, you'll be getting snow soon as they start moving over the mountain.
Smoke needed to be on the other side of the mountain range, and he was afraid that the snow might be so heavy as to close the pass. So, though every ounce of him wanted to hole up somewhere long enough to ride the storm out, he pushed on through, fighting the cold, stinging snow in his face until he reached the top of the pass. He made it through and had started looking for a place to spend the night when he saw the boy. He almost didn't see him. There was a big drift of snow so that only the boy's head and shoulders were sticking out. He was under an overhanging ledge, and his head was back and his eyes were closed.
Damn. Who is that?
What's he doing here?
Smoke stared in shocked surprise at the young boy. Was he sleeping? Or was he dead? The boy's face and lips were blue, and there were ice crystals in his eyebrows and hair. The blanket around him, which was his only protection against the cold, was frozen. It didn't look good.
Here, try some of this.
Matt opened his eyes and saw a man sitting on a bed beside him, holding a cup. He took the cup and raised it to his mouth.
Ow!
He jerked it away when it burned his lips.
Oh, maybe I should have told you it was hot.
Matt tried again. It was hot and bracing and good.
Yeah. What is it?
Broth made from beaver.
Don't know that I've ever tasted beaver before. What's so funny?
I'll say this for you, boy. You do have sand. You sure seem to be taking this in stride.
Matt took another swallow, then looked around. He was in a room, or more accurately, a one-room cabin. There was a fireplace on one side in which a fire was burning briskly, putting out enough heat to warm the entire room. The interior walls were made of mud-chinked logs. There was a table and several chairs, a couple of chests, and a wall rack that held three rifles and a shotgun. Antlers hung on the wall, and bearskins lay on the floor. The very bed he was lying on had skins as well as blankets.
Beaver broth is good.
I made some biscuits.
Matt's host handed one to him.
Whoa! Slow down. You'll make yourself sick. How long has it been since you ate?
I don't know. I don't even know how long I've been here.
I brought you here night before last. You've been asleep the whole time. In fact, I wasn't sure I'd ever be able to wake you up. I was thinking I would have to bury you out back somewhere.
Where is here?
Yeah, I'll tell you where here is after you answer some of my questions. Who are you?
My name is Matt.
Matt what?
Just Matt.
The man nodded.
All right. Just Matt. That's good enough for me. My name is Smoke Jensen.
Smoke? You mean, like smoke from a fire?
Yes.
Never heard of such a name.
I've never heard of someone who's just Matt.
I'm sorry. I guess if your name is Smoke, then that's your name.
Well, my real name is Kirby. Kirby Jensen. But folks have called me Smoke from the time I was a kid. So it sort of belongs to me now.
You were gonna tell me where I am?
You're in my cabin in Gorge Range.
Gore Range? What's the Gore Range?
It's a mountain range in Colorado.
Oh.
Are you lost, Matt?
No, I'm not lost. I knew I was in Colorado.
Well, as long as you knew you were in Colorado...
Matt took another swallow of the broth.
Tell you what, Matt. As soon as you got your strength, I'll take you back.
No. I won't go back.
He tried to get up and get out of bed, but he was too weak. And he fell back onto the bed.
Here, hold on there. You're too weak to be doing that.
I'm not going back.
All right, if you don't want to go back, I won't make you. But don't you think your Ma and Pa might be worrying about you?
My Ma and Pa are both dead. They've been dead for 3 years.
I see. So, where is it you don't want to go back to? Are you living with relatives or something?
Matt shook his head and finished the broth. He handed the cup to Smoke.
Is there any more?
Yeah, there's more.
And another biscuit, please?
Smoke refilled the cup with broth and handed it and another biscuit to Matt.
Thank you, sir. It's an orphanage. Only it's called the Home for Wayward Boys and Girls. None of us are really wayward, though. Only thing is, we're all just orphans.
So if it's just an orphanage, why'd you run away?
You wouldn't understand.
Maybe I wouldn't. But in the meantime, you can put your mind at ease. I'm not going to make you go back.
I don't want to be a burden on you, sir. So, as soon as I get my strength back, I'll be going on. Just tell me the way to the nearest town so I can find a job somewhere.
Well, the nearest town is a good 50 more miles from here. And even if you knew where it was, you wouldn't be able to make it. Most of the high passes are filled by snow by now. You wouldn't be able to get through.
Oh.
So, I'm afraid you're going to have to stay here with me.
Stay here? Stay here for how long?
4, 5 months. Till the high passes are open.
I'm awful sorry, sir.
What are you sorry about?
I'm sorry I'm going to have to stay here and put you out.
Well, don't worry about it. In the first place, I could use the company. It gets awfully lonely sometimes, spending a winter in a cabin like this all by yourself. And in the second place, you won't be putting me out because I aim to see to it that you earn your keep.
Yes, sir. I'll do whatever you ask me to do, Mr. Jensen.
Is that a promise?
Yes, sir.
Then I'm going to ask you not to call me Mr. Jensen. Name Smoke. That's what I'll be wanting you to call me.
All right. Smoke.
First thing we're going to have to do is build you a bed. The bed you've been sleeping in for the last 2 days belongs to me. And I don't plan on sharing it.
I've made my bed, but I don't think I've ever built one before.
Matt, during your stay with me, you're going to be doing a lot of things you never done before. It doesn't make the best coffee.
Smoke poured a dark substance into the bottom of a coffee pot.
But if you roast dandelion root, then crush it up and boil it, well, the coffee's passing.
Meat smells good.
Matt was talking about a cut of venison that was cooking in a roaster sitting on a rock at the back of the fireplace. Wild carrots and wild leeks surrounded the meat and were now bubbling in the meat juices.
Meat, carrots, and cattail roots will make a fine meal. Afterward, we'll have dessert of wild blueberry pine coffee.
I had no idea there were so many things you could eat in the wild. I mean, think about it. I nearly starved to death out there, and there were all sorts of things to eat.
Well, don't feel bad about it. I wouldn't have known about it either if it hadn't been for Preacher.
Preacher must be quite a fella. I'd like to meet him someday.
He will. The thing about Preacher is, he likes his time alone.
Why is that?
He's an old-time mountain man. One of the originals.
You're a mountain man, too.
Yeah, I am. But I don't plan to spend my whole life in the mountains. Truth is, I like civilization too much. One of these days, I intend to get myself a ranch and settle down.
Not me.
You don't want to settle down?
No, sir. I want to just wander around from place to place.
I guess you'll get to see a lot of the country that way.
Matt was quiet for a long moment.
After I killed some people.
Smoke didn't reply.
I reckon you think that's wrong of me, don't you? Saying that I'm going to kill some people?
It depends on who you're going to kill and why you're going to kill them.
I only know the names of two of them. One is Payson. And the other is Garvey.
Are those their first names or last?
I don't know.
Would you know these people if you saw them?
Yes, I'd know them. Payson has a long, ugly purple scar on his face, and it's made his eye look funny.
Matt used his finger to illustrate the scar.
Garvey only has half an ear.
You said your ma and pa are dead. Did these fellas kill him?
Yes, and my big sister, too. They were also gonna, with my mom and my sister, they were gonna, I don't know how to say it.
Rape.
Matt was quiet for a moment. His eyes brimmed with tears, then they began flowing down his cheeks. He held back his sobs as he brushed the tears away. Finally, he nodded.
Yes. One of them was gonna rape my mom and sister. My mom and sis were already dead, but he was gonna do it anyway.
You said he was going to. But he didn't.
Matt shook his head.
Nope.
What stopped him?
I did. When they shot Pa, I grabbed Pa's rifle and I ran. Like a coward, I ran.
Smoke shook his head.
I wasn't being cowardly, Matt. I was being smart.
I managed to get behind some rocks and I climbed up so I could see. By the time I got there, it was too late. Ma and Cassie were already dead. One of them was standing over my ma. Unbuttoning his pants. Getting ready to...
He paused for a moment before he continued.
To be honest with you, Smoke, I was 9 years old then, so I didn't really know what he was planning to do. I thought maybe he was going to pee on him. So I shot him in the head.
Good for you.
After I shot that one of the others tried to come after me, but he got wedged in between a couple of rocks and couldn't get to me. So I shot him, too.
What do you think about that?
What do you mean?
Do you think what you did was wrong?
I don't know. I mean, I know it's wrong to kill people, but I also know that soldiers kill people. My pa was a soldier in the war. He'd kill people, and I know he wasn't a bad man.
Yeah, that's something to think about, Matt. Good men can kill good men during a war, and there can't be anything wrong with a good man killing an evil man.
Matt smiled and nodded.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but I think you're right.
Yeah, smells like supper's ready.
It's good. I'm starving.
If anyone else told me they were starving, I'd figure they didn't know what they were talking about. But seeing as how you actually were starving when I found you, then I guess you don't fall into that category.
Throughout the long winter, Smoke began teaching his young protege things he needed to know to get by. In the teaching, he felt almost as if he was doing nature's bidding, passing along things he had learned from Preacher. And, just as it wasn't a father-son relationship between Smoke and Preacher, neither was this a father-son relationship. But the fact that they didn't share a familial bond didn't mean the relationship wasn't just as strong, nor the continuity as valid as it would have been if they had.
Just because we're living out here in the wilds doesn't mean we don't have laws that we follow.
Smoke thought back to almost the same conversation he'd once had with Preacher.
Only out here, it isn't laws that you find written on paper or in books. And it isn't laws that have to have sheriffs enforcing or judges settling.
What kind of laws are they?
You might say they're the laws of decency and good sense. For example, don't go putting your hands on another man's wife. Don't steal from him. Don't cheat him. And don't call him a liar. You do that, somebody's going to get killed.
Somebody? Don't you mean the man that's doing the wrong?
Smoke shook his head.
Not always. Sometimes the one who is wronged has no choice but to try and defend those laws. But if the one who wronged him is faster and better with a gun, then the wrong man dies.
I see what you mean.
I hope you do see what I mean, Matt. Because I'm going to teach you how to use a gun. By the time I get through with you, there'll be few, if any, in the country who'll be able to stand up to you. But with that comes the responsibility of knighthood.
Knighthood?
You heard about knights, haven't you?
Yeah, I've seen pictures, but they're the guys who wore the iron suits, right?
Right. Those suits were called armor. The knights were appointed by the king, and he made sure that he only appointed the best men for the job. You see, the knights were so strong, they could kill anyone they wanted to, but they didn't. They took an oath to never use their power to enrich themselves, but always just to help others.
Are you a knight, Smoke?
Smoke nodded.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking, you might say that I'm a knight. I respect the rights of others, and I settle my own accounts without running to the sheriff.
Well, how do you settle accounts?
Say a cougar is sneaking up on my horse. Do you think I should go to a sheriff or judge to complain?
No, sir.
Well, what would you do?
I'd shoot the cougar.
Uh-huh. It's the same with a man, Matt. If a man calls you out, you don't go to the sheriff or judge. You deal with him, straight and simple.
Like Payson and Garvey?
Like Payson and Garvey.
As soon as the streams melted and the water began flowing again, Smoke asked Matt to come down to the creek with him.
We going fishing?
Something like that.
Smoke handed Matt a pan.
Never fished with a pan before.
Matt looked at the pan.
That's because you never fished for gold before.
Gold? You fish for gold?
I do.
The walk from the cabin to the creek was about half a mile. There, a wide bed of gravel wound its way through the valley, and in the middle of the bed of gravel was a creek, approximately 30 yards wide. The creek ran cold and clear, except where the whitewater broke over the rocks.
It's very pretty here.
Yes, it is.
Is this where we're gonna fish for gold?
Yes, but it isn't called fishing. It's called panning. Pay attention.
All right.
The first thing you have to do is look around for the best location to work. You want to find yourself a spot where the water is at least 6 inches deep and flowing just fast enough to keep the muddy water from getting into your pan. And also, it's nice if you can find a rock that'll let you sit down.
Smoke continued his lesson, demonstrating as he talked.
Fill the pan about 3/4 full of gravel, then hold it deep enough so it's just under the water. Shake it back and forth from side to side, not so hard that you wash anything out of the pan, and keep doing this until everything heavy goes to the bottom of the pan and the lighter stuff comes to the top. And turn the pan just enough to pour out the lighter rocks. After that, you sort of swirl things around in the pan and look at what you have and... ha!
Smoke reached down into the pan.
Here, this is what we're looking for.
Smoke held a little rock in his hand, not much bigger than a pea.
That's just a rock.
Smoke turned it, and Matt saw a quick flash in the sun.
Not just a rock.
It's gold!
Smoke nodded.
If there's gold in this creek, why aren't more people up here doing this?
Right now, only 3 people know about it. Preacher, me, and you. I'd like to keep it that way.
Wow! This is fun!
I'm glad you think so, because this is what we're going to be doing all summer.
There wasn't much to the little town of Cedar Creek. It was hot, dry, and dusty, out in the middle of nowhere and baking under the blows of the hot September sun. An old yellow dog slept under the front porch of the general store, the shade shared by a black and white cat. School had just started, and on the school grounds, a group of Miss Miller's second grade students were laughing and playing during their afternoon recess. The children played and the rest of the town went about its business, unaware of a drama unfolding inside the bank of Cedar Creek. 7 men, wearing yellow dusters and brandishing guns, were holding the bank employees and customers at bay. The bank robbers wore bandanas tied around their faces, but a puffy scar marked the leader of the group. The old wound started above his left eye, disfiguring the eye as it streaked down his cheek like a purple flash of lightning, and disappeared under the bandana. Even as Payson and his men were robbing the bank, Jason Feeler walked up the boardwalk carrying an envelope. The envelope contained $12.75, a deposit from the livery stable. Jason, 17, felt pleased Mr. Heckemeyer considered him responsible enough to take the overnight receipts to the bank. As Jason reached the front of the bank, he looked in through the window.
Oh my God!
Mr. Fitzhugh, the bank president, stood against the wall with his hands in the air. So did several others. Mr. Boykin knelt in front of the safe, twisting the dial, while a masked man stood behind him, holding a gun against his head. There were 6 other robbers in the bank. Fitzhugh saw Jason and made a slight motion with his head. Jason understood, nodded, then left the front of the bank. As soon as he was clear of the bank, he started running. A moment later, he pushed open the door to the marshal's office.
The bank's being robbed, Marshal Cobb!
What?
There's some men with guns robbing the bank. They're in there now.
Marshal Cobb pulled a rifle down from the gun rack and tossed it to Jason. Then he pulled another one down for himself.
Get down to the general store. Tell anyone you find there to get ready. I'm going to get help from the saloon.
Spurred on by the warning and moving quickly and quietly enough to avoid giving the bank robbers any sign of what they were doing, the men blocked off both escape routes out of town. They pushed wagons across the street to use as barricades. Then, with rifles, pistols, and shotguns, they took up their positions. Armed and ready, they stared back toward the bank, watching and waiting. Inside the bank, unaware of the ambush being set for them outside, the scar-faced man held his gun on the bank teller kneeling in front of the vault door, nervously twisting the combination dial.
Mister, if you don't have that lock open in 30 seconds, I'm gonna blow your brains all over the front of this safe.
I'm trying to open it, but I'm so scared that I keep making mistakes.
The scar-faced man cocked his pistol and pressed the barrel against the teller's temple.
Yeah? Well, don't make any more, because the next mistake will be your last one.
The teller started spinning the dial again.
Garvey, what's it look like outside?
Damn it, Payson, you just said my name.
Yeah, and you just said mine.
Like Payson, Garvey had a very distinguishing feature. The lobe of his left ear had been shot off, leaving him only half an ear on that side. He moved over to the window and pulled the green curtains aside so he could look out into the street.
Never mind. What does it look like?
It looks quiet.
There was a click as the vault door came unlocked.
There, that's more like it.
Payson pulled a sack from the pocket of his duster and handed it to the teller.
Now, fill her up.
The teller reached for the coin drawer.
Oh, to hell with them coins. I want greenbacks.
Payson waved his pistol toward a drawer full of banded stacks of bills.
Yes, sir.
With trembling hands, the teller began scooping up the banknote packages and dropping them into the bag.
Hurry it up. We ain't got all day.
Marshal, look!
Through all their preparation, no one thought to warn Miss Miller and her second grade pupils. The games of recess continued without interruption.
Somebody needs to get them kids out of there.
All right, go down there and...
The front door of the bank swung open and seven men dashed toward the horses tied at the hitching rail.
No, wait. It's too late now.
Cobb raised up from his position.
You men hold it right there. You ain't going nowhere.
At almost the same time Cobb shouted, he fired. His bullet went through Garvey's hat, knocking it into the dirt.
What the hell? Payson, look out! It's a trap!
Pope, Sill, Bart, Pete, Clem, get mounted. Let's get out of here. Let's go, let's go!
The outlaws opened fire as they started for their own mounts. From the front porch of Lambert's Cafe, a citizen with food stains on his shirt appeared with a shotgun. He let go a blast, but the range was too great. His pellets peppered the outlaws without penetrating their skin. Another man fired a shotgun from a little closer range, and the front window of the bank came crashing down. Once the robbers were mounted, they started down the street at a full gallop, while two dozen armed townsmen fired at them from every possible position.
Son of a bitch! They got Pete!
Pope reached over to try and steady Pete on his horse, but the outlaw fell.
Payson! Pete's down!
Leave him!
Payson and his gang reached the end of the street, only to find the barricade.
Damn, the guy's locked off! What do we do, Payson?
This way!
Payson led the way riding back through the town in the opposite direction. They were galloping hard when they came up on the barricade that had been erected at the other end of town. They had to pull up short. The horses, now as panic-stricken as the men, twisted around in nervous circles and reared up, anxious to run, but not sure where to go. It was all the riders could do to control them.
They got us locked off at both ends! There!
Sill pointed toward the schoolyard.
We can go through there!
Without answering, Payson and the others veered off the street and headed straight for the schoolyard. The children, frightened by the exploding gunshots, had gathered around Miss Miller. The teacher was also rooted to the spot by her own terror.
Hold your fire, men! Hold your fire! We might hit one of the kids!
With the marshal's order, the fire of the townspeople stopped, giving Payson and his men a chance to get away. When Payson reached the alley behind the school, he and the others turned and fired back through the playground at the townspeople. Then they galloped away.
This way, men! Set up a skirmish line at the end of the alley! Jake, Slim, set up at each end! The rest of you lie between them and fire!
Marshal Cobb led them through the schoolyard to the alley, where they formed a skirmish line of shooters, firing at the cloud of dust as the riders grew smaller and smaller in the distance.
Cease fire! Cease fire! Just wasting ammunition now. They're well out of range.
Marshal, you ain't gonna just let them get away, are you?
Nothing I can do about it. They're out of town now. I got no jurisdiction.
Looking back, they saw one of the outlaws lying dead in the street.
At least we got one of them.
Yeah, and they got two of us. Look over there.
My God.
For the first time, the men saw that Miss Miller and a little girl were lying on the ground, victims of the outlaw's last fusillade. The fallen figures were surrounded by the other children, who looked down at their teacher and their friend in shocked silence.
Somebody get a doctor, quick!
We won't be needing a doctor, Marshal. What we need is an undertaker. They're both dead.
The outlaws were in full gallop, running away from the town. They ran the horses for several minutes before Bart Ebersol got concerned.
Payson, if we don't give these horses a blow, they're gonna drop dead under us.
Yeah, all right, pull up.
The six outlaws stopped the gallop. Then dismounted and walked their horses to let them regain their breath.
Anyone else hit? Garvey, Pope, Sill, Clem, Bart?
Nah, except for Pete, we come through fine.
Damn, boys, that was good! Jesse James don't have a thing on us.
Matt stood just outside Smoke's cabin, throwing a knife at a target he had carved on a tree. The hunting knife, a gift from Smoke, was perfectly balanced for throwing, and whenever he had time during the long summer days, Matt would practice.
Hey, Matt, let's see how good you really are.
Smoke threw his knife from his perch in the cabin door. Hitting the target on the tree, dead center. Smiling, Matt threw his own knife at the target, hitting so close to the one Smoke threw that the blades actually touched.
Whoa! You've gotten pretty good with that.
Thanks.
Matt walked out to the tree and pulled both knives free.
You remember what I said about going into town when summer was over?
I remember.
Well, summer's over. Why don't we go to the corral and pick out your horse?
My horse?
Yeah, your horse. Man's gotta have a horse.
Which horse is mine?
Why don't you take the best one, except for that one.
Smoke pointed to an Appaloosa over in one corner of the corral.
That one's mine.
Which horse is the best?
I'm willing to give you the best horse in my string, but as to which horse that is, well, you're just going to have to figure that out yourself.
Matt walked out to Smoke's small corral. He leaned on the split rail fence and looked at the string of seven horses. After looking them over carefully, Matt smiled and nodded.
Made your choice?
Yes.
Which one?
I want that one.
Matt pointed to the bay.
Why not the chestnut? He looks stronger.
Look at the chestnut's front feet. They're splayed. The bay's feet are just right.
What about the black one over there?
Uh-uh. His back legs are set too far back. I want the bay.
Smoke reached out and ran his hand through Matt's hair.
You're learning, kid. You're learning. The bay is yours.
Matt's grin spread from ear to ear.
I never had a horse before.
Matt jumped down from the rail fence and started toward the horse.
That's all right. He's never had a rider before.
What?
Matt jerked around in surprise as he stared at Smoke.
Did you say that he's never been ridden?
He's as spirited as he was the day we brought him in.
How am I going to ride him if he's never been ridden?
Well, I reckon you're just going to have to break him in.
Break him? I can't break a horse.
Sure you can. It'll be fun.
Smoke showed Matt how to saddle a horse and gave him some pointers on riding it.
Now, you don't want to break the horse's spirit. What you want to do is make him your partner.
How do I do that?
Walk him around for a bit so he gets used to his saddle and to you. Then, get on.
He won't throw me then?
Oh, he'll still throw you a few times, but at least he'll know how serious you are.
To Matt's happy surprise, he wasn't thrown even once. The horse did buck a few times, coming down on stiff legs, then sunfishing, and finally galloping at full speed around the corral. But after a few minutes, he stopped fighting, and Matt leaned over to pat him gently on the neck.
Good boy. Good fella.
Good job, Matt. You've got a real touch with horses. You didn't break him. You trained him. And that's real good. He's not mean, but he still has spirit.
Smoke? Can I name him?
Sure. He's your horse. You can name him anything you want.
Matt continued to pat the horse on the neck as he thought of a name.
That's it. I've come up with a name.
What are you going to call him?
Spirit.
Smoke nodded.
Yeah. Spirit. That's a good name. The Indians will like that name.
Wonder how long it'll take him to learn his name.
Yeah, not too long. What do you say we get started into town now?
How far is town?
About 50 miles north of here. We'll spend tonight on the trail and get there sometime tomorrow.
Smoke, we're not going to the town of Soda Creek, are we?
Soda Creek? No. Why the concern? Is that where the orphanage was?
Yes, and I don't want to go back there. I don't even want to go to the town.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Soda Creek is south, and we're going north. You know how to find north?
Well, I know the sun rises in the east.
And what if it's nighttime? Can't see the sun.
I know about the North Star.
That's good. Do you know how to find the North Star?
The Big Dipper. All you do is line up the two stars on the cup of the Dipper, and you can find the North Star. Pa showed me how to do that when we were on the trail.
Good for your pa. That's a good thing to know. But what if you're in trees or something so that, for some reason, you can't see the stars? Did you know that you can also find north with the moon?
No. I didn't know you could do that.
On a fairly full moon, you can see a crescent of shadows. The finger in the crescent points to the north. When the moon is at a phase where you can see where the shadow starts, you can find north by making an imaginary line from the tip of the shadow to the north.
Well, that's good to know.
If you can keep a few things like that in mind, you might be able to locate yourself just a little closer than by saying you're in Colorado.
Matt recalled insisting to Smoke that he wasn't lost because he knew he was in Colorado. The two men rode on through the afternoon. Then Smoke held up his hand as a signal to stop.
We'll camp here tonight. There's water, and it's always good to camp by water, as long as you know the dangers.
What's dangerous about camping near water?
All critters need water. Squirrels, rabbits, horses, men, dogs, and the like. But so do bears, and mountain lions, and wolves. And some of them are pretty possessive. If they see you around their water hole, they aren't going to like it. So you're going to have to stay alert the whole time you're by a water hole.
Matt remembered his encounter with the wolf when he was on the trail, running away from the home.
I see.
Also, the water might be poison.
Poison? How? Why?
You don't always know why the water would be poison. But there's bad water out there, and you'll run across it from time to time.
Well, how do you tell if it's poison? By taste?
Nah, it's not good enough. Some bad water tastes pretty good. Some good water tastes awfully bad. About the only way you can really tell is to take a look around it. If you see the bones of dead animals real close to the water hole, the chances are they died drinking the water. That's a good sign for you to just keep moving on.
I'll try to remember that.
You'll try? I hope you remember everything I tell you. Otherwise, I'm just out here batting my gums for nothing.
I will remember.
There was no town called Mule Crossing. It was a place about 15 miles west of Meeker, where the White River could be forded. Here, a man named John Grant had built a saloon and general store. The man who came into Grant's saloon stood at the front door for just a minute, allowing his eyes to adjust to the darkness. He was about average size, with a drawn face, watery blue eyes, a hooked nose, and a sweeping handlebar mustache. He wore a low-crowned black hat encircled with a silver hatband, from which protruded a small red feather.
My name is Amos Bodine, and I'm looking for a man by the name of Cleo Wright.
There were only six others in the saloon, and Bodine studied each one of them. All but one returned his gaze. The one who did not was making a point of staring at his drink.
You, what's your name?
Smith. John Smith.
Another man came in behind Bodine then, and the fact that Bodine didn't look around indicated that he knew who it was.
He's lying, Amos. I seen him at the trial before he broke jail. This here's Cleo Wright.
Well, Mr. Cleo Wright.
A wicked smile spread across Bodine's face.
There's a reward out for you, did you know that?
Wright stepped away from the bar and faced Bodine.
Yeah, I know that.
Tell you what, you pay me the reward money and I'll let you go.
I don't have any money.
And I guess I'm just gonna have to take you in, unless you can stop me.
Stop you? How am I supposed to stop you?
Well, you could draw against me, you might get lucky. Or you can just show everyone in here what a sniveling, low-ass coward you are, and get down on your belly and slither out to your horse.
What? What are you asking me to do?
You heard me. You can either draw against me, or get down on your belly and slither across the floor like the cowardly snake you are.
No way in hell am I gonna do that, mister.
The smile remained on Bodine's face.
Then you're gonna have to draw against me.
The expression on Cleo Wright's face turned from one of anger to fear, then to resignation. Wright made a desperate grab for his gun. Bodine's gun was out and firing before Wright was able to clear leather with his own pistol. Wright went down with a bullet in his heart.